Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, why the Chinese internet is more vibrant than you might think.
And we meet Phoenix's new economic development director and talk about his plans for the city's future.
But first,
nationally, the upcoming 2026 midterm elections are looking bleak for Republicans. Recent elections and polling show the GOP could be in for a tough time when voters show up to the polls in November. Here in Arizona, though, Republicans have only grown their voter registration advantage heading into the midterms. In November 2020, there were 130,000 more registered Republicans than Democrats in Arizona. Today, that lead is up to 330,000 voters. But our next guest this morning says he still thinks it's Democrats who have the headwinds, even in Arizona this year. Stephen Richer is former Maricopa County reporter. Today, he's an opinion contributor to the Arizona Republic, as well as a lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School. And he joins me now to talk more about his latest op-ed for the paper. Thanks for coming back on, Stephen.
Of course. Always a pleasure.
All right. So Republicans have quite the voter registration advantage here in Arizona, and it's only gotten bigger. Why do you think it's Democrats who might end up taking the lead in Arizona in November, though?
Yeah, I don't want to skip over that headline because for an allegedly purple state, we're more and more red. And I think the Republicans are to be commended for the ground game that has registered a really an impressive number of voters over the last few years. So that's going to be structurally very difficult for Democrats to contest with over the in the future. But regarding the 2026 midterm elections, as you mentioned, races throughout the country for the past year and a half have heavily favored the Democratic candidates. Districts that President Trump won in 2024 are going by significant numbers to Democrats. Democrats won the governor's race in both New Jersey and in Virginia by margins that were much larger than expected. And then here locally, all the candidates who are running in the most competitive, most high-profile races, attorney general, governor, secretary of state, they have incumbents who are Democrats. And so I think that inures to their advantage as well. Mm. And then the biggest thing on the map is people are feeling pretty down about President Trump right now. His approval ratings are quite low, and the issues that he's talking about, whether it's Greenland, whether it's ICE, aren't the issues that Americans really trust him for. They voted him in based off of kitchen table issues and securing the border. And now when they see things like what's going on in Minneapolis or hearing about Venezuela, they're less enamored with the president.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing low polling numbers there, especially when it comes to ICE. But you know, President Trump is not on the ballot in November. Do you think that changes things?
President Trump isn't on the ballot, which in and of itself is a bit problematic for Republicans these days, because unlike maybe the Republican Party of old, which were tended to be more educated, more affluent voters who showed up in every election, you have a lot of people who are part of this new Trump coalition who really care about Donald Trump, but don't care about the rest of the party all that much. And so they might not turn up. And yes, I do think that for the Dems, they really care about President Trump and they want to push back against him. And though, even though he's not on the ballot, I think many Dems realize that if they take control of either the United States House or the United States Senate, they'll be able to exert a lot more oversight on the president.
Right. So it's also about like who shows up to vote. You're talking about these high propensity voters. And you write that like it's changed even in the last just couple of presidential elections. Democrats are now the ones who are the affluent, educated folks who turn out to vote more often.
It's amazing. But I think in many ways, Trump has reformed the Republican Party into the working class party. And the Democrats get the majority of voters who are making over $100,000 a year. And that's true not just at the presidential level, but it was true in 2022 of the gubernatorial election between Katie Hobbs and Carrie Lake. Katie Hobbs, Governor Hobbs, won the majority of people in Arizona who make over $100,000. And those people, yes, tend to show up and vote in midterm elections at a higher rate than people who make less than that.
At the same time, you're talking about this really massive and growing GOP voter registration advantage. You write that it's now 7.6%. It's larger than any presidential cycle registration margin in recent state history. So essentially, are you looking for Republicans who you think will vote Democratic or split the ticket?
Again, that's the elephant in the room, pun intended, is that, yes, Republicans have a very significant now and growingly significant registration advantage. So what will have to happen for Democrats to win? One of the registered Democrats, a higher percentage will need to show up and vote than of the registered Republicans. Two, you'll need to have some crossover registered Republicans who vote for Democrats, but that doesn't happen all that often. And then three, you'll need to clean up with the very sizable percentage of Arizonans who are registered as no party declared or independent. That's about 34% of the state.
And always a big factor in Arizona, right? Those independents or no party affiliated voters. It's sometimes in the history of Arizona voter registration been the biggest party in the state, the non-party.
That's right. And I think the winning coalition for Katie Hobbs will have to look similar to her winning coalition in 2022. The good news for her is that she's an incumbent, and she's had 3.5 years so far to show what she's about, to establish her brand, I think develop relationships with more Arizona businesses that could help. And at the same time, I don't think that she's pissed off anyone in her base. And so I think that from that standpoint, she's stronger, in a stronger position than she was 3.5 years ago.
And 3.5 years ago, we should say, we saw some incredibly tight races, including the governor's race. Do you anticipate seeing that again?
For better or for worse, I think that's going to be Arizona's fate for at least the next few years. I think that'll be true, especially with respect to the attorney general race and the governor's race. But look, based off of these voter registration statistics, Republicans are in the position, they've done the groundwork to win races by 5% plus or more. What they need is they need the national sentiment to pick up. They need the economy to be strong. And they need President Trump to focus on the issues that those everyday Arizonans, those everyday Americans care about. And maybe clean up a bit on things like ICE in Minneapolis and whether or not Greenland's important.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Stephen Richer, former Maricopa County recorder, opinion contributor to the Arizona Republic, and lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School, joining us. Stephen, thank you so much for coming back on. We always appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Maria Rosario Jackson recently returned to ASU. She'd been a professor there previously, but took a break a few years ago for a pretty cool job. Former President Joe Biden nominated her to be chair of the National Endowment for the Arts. She served in the role until last year, and now she is back at ASU, where she's a professor of creativity and social impact. She's planning to build on the work she did with the NEA, where she saw her role as encouraging Americans to live what she calls an artful life. When I spoke to her last week, I asked her what that means to her.
It certainly includes the most conventional ways that people think about cultural participation, like visiting a museum or going to a concert or seeing a play in venues that are intended for the distribution and dissemination of professional art forms. And it also means the kinds of things that you might do at home could be traditions that are passed down from one generation to another that are meaningful because they are about storytelling. They are about creative expression. It's the full range, right? So it's things that might happen in parks and community centers and public streets, and the things that we are more conventionally familiar with.
Yeah. Well, if I'm not mistaken, in addition to the arts, you have a strong background in community development, public policy, urban planning. And I know, for example, when you were at NEA, You did partnerships with Department of Health and Human Services and the EPA and FEMA. What did those look like, and how are those reflective of these ideas?
Yeah, I think that at their most powerful, artists, the work of artists, the work of cultural organizations, I think that all of that is at its most powerful when it's not in a silo. But when we think of it as fully integrated into how we build communities where all people can thrive and reach their full potential, when you think about it in that way, that it should be part of all of the things that we care about, then the role of arts administrators, artists, cultural organizations, it takes on some different additional realms. So there were all of these opportunities to think about how the arts could be really core to so many of the things that we aspire to as a nation.
Yeah. And there is this idea sometimes in culture, please tell me if you disagree, that, you know, the public is kind of doing an artist or an arts organization a favor by paying attention. and that, you know, art sort of is like this thing that floats above the rest of quote unquote normal life. But what you're saying, if I'm not misunderstanding, is that we can reorient our ways of thinking
right.
about art as something that is actually like it's all part of the same mission.
Yes. And I think, you know, there are some cultures that have never made the disconnection,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, you think of some Native American cultures or the kind of practices that allow us to make meaning, ask questions, dream, mm-hmm. Connect to each other, connect to the divine, which are all, you know, all these things. We do this through the arts, express our full humanity, and hopefully see the humanity of others.
Yeah.
When that is not viewed as apart from how we live every day,
right.
there's a great deal more potential for power. I feel like it's most useful to think about the arts and participation in cultural life as a precondition for all of the other things that we want to accomplish. Because ultimately, if we can't see our own humanity and that of others, we don't have much of a shot of building systems that actually allow us to care for each other.
Yeah. You know, that makes me think about something that you said once with regard to the FEMA partnership. You said, quote, some of that work was thinking about how cultural resilience is a component of a more comprehensive understanding of resilience. Am I making that connection properly? That there's this,
yes.
there's this idea
yes.
in that sentiment to me that oftentimes art is about the resilience of the human spirit, and we have to believe in that in order to build infrastructure around it.
Yes, I think that's right. And you know, when we were working with FEMA, the beauty of that particular collaboration was that it had at least two prongs, and one was helping the agency to better understand how artists and cultural organizations operate, and to make sure that when there were programs to address disaster and recovery from disaster, that those entities were understood sufficiently such that they could also benefit maximally. But the other strand really had to do with what you just brought up, and that is recognizing that artists and cultural organizations are sometimes positioned in ways to help get through trauma, mm-hmm. to help imagine how to rebuild something that has been decimated,
mm-hmm.
to remind people that life is still available to them and joy is still available. Getting that kind of sensibility into a federal system that is intended to advance resiliency and deal with some of the most dire circumstances that people will sometimes have in their lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed really important. And we were We had a terrific relationship with some of our colleagues in public service from that agency, you know, at the time when I was doing that work. And that's just one example, but there were lots.
Yeah. Well, I know another portion of your time there that, as I understand it, was very impactful for you were you did some traveling in Native American communities.
Yes, absolutely. So, and that was very impactful, the work in Native American communities and the work in many communities where there was a commitment to, in some cases, retrieving art forms and art practices that had been interrupted or where there had been an attempt to historically erase them. And often the generosity that comes with something that you find important and valuable and is expressive of what is most important about a people and to be willing to even share that.
Yeah.
That's very hopeful work.
Yes. Well, this comes to your return to ASU. Tell us about what that looks like so far and what it will look like going forward.
So some of that is still a work in progress, but I will tell you that I'm really interested in food, how nourishment isn't only caloric or chemical, but when you think about the growing of the food, the preparation of it, the sharing of it, the human connection, aesthetics, concern with joy, and all of that is part of nourishment.
Well, I have been speaking with Professor Maria Rosario Jackson, ASU University Professor of Creative and Social Impact, and the former chair of the National Endowment for the Arts. Professor Jackson, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. This was wonderful to be in conversation with you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, how internet restrictions in China took shape and how they're holding up now.
Often people who aren't on the Chinese internet or haven't been to China kind of assume that the ecosystem that exists behind this great firewall is totally barren. Like nothing is allowed in. You can't have Facebook. You can't have Google. Sensitive words vanish. And there's no innovation and no culture and no community. But, you know, that couldn't be further from the truth.
We'll hear from a journalist and author of a new book chronicling the innovations happening now on the Chinese internet.
But first, the city of Phoenix's new community and economic director believes in the upward trajectory of this city. Ryan Tuhill has spent his career in Virginia, but the possibility of the Valley of the Sun drew him to the desert this year after longtime economic director Christine Mackey left to take the helm at the Greater Phoenix Economic Council. Tuhill came into our studios recently to talk about his new role, his views of the city and the challenges it faces. And he told me he's wanted to move here since he and his wife came to visit last year.
We were impressed by the stunning beauty of this place and the warm and welcoming community. And we really decided that if we were going to pick up and move somewhere across the country, we want to be in a place where we feel that we can build a life. And that felt exactly like what Phoenix had. It felt like home, to be honest.
So here you are. Okay. Yeah. So let's talk about Phoenix and kind of your impressions of it, especially in terms of development here. We have for a long time, I think, been like the poster child of growth, just stretching into the desert forever. Where do you see the opportunity right now when it comes to business? What industries? I know we hear a lot about TSMC and semiconductors. There are literally entire neighborhoods being built around that right now. But what else?
Well, what impressed me when I dug in and started learning about Phoenix, and since I've been here for just over 2 months, is it's not just one industry that we're focused on. We're focused on a number of industries, advanced manufacturing and semiconductors for sure, but we have a very robust bioscience industry here. We have a growing aerospace and defense industry. And technology is becoming a huge part of our growth for the future. everything from autonomous vehicles like the Waymos you see driving around to autonomous drones and aircraft, and then all the way down to medical devices that might be implanted into a patient. And so all of that work is happening here, and that's really important because it allows us to have more resiliency, economic resiliency, so that if there is a downturn in one industry, then others can step up and continue to support the Phoenix economy and the community here.
So not everything coming from one place.
That's right. Yeah.
When you are talking to companies about trying to come here, especially as someone who's new here yourself, like what's your sell? Like what questions you get? How do you talk to them about it?
Well, the first thing we talk about is the growing labor force or workforce that we have here. We've seen tremendous growth in population in the last 10 years. For 2010 to 2024, I think we grew by 15.6%. I mean, added 200,000 more people. That's translating into more workers. And we're seeing the educational attainment of our workforce increase. In that same period, bachelor's degrees or higher that have been attained have grown by 83%. So employers come here, come to a location generally because they can get a great workforce. That's still the number one factor we hear when we're talking to companies about location decisions is what does the talent look like? Will I have the workforce to support my company and future growth? And the answer in Phoenix is yes.
Is that on all ends of the economic spectrum? Like are you looking at – you're mentioning people with college degrees, but is it people working in factories, things like that as well?
Yes. We're seeing growth in educational attainment across the board, which is really helpful because not every job requires a college degree for sure. But then we start to sell Phoenix itself. This is a great place to live. It's a great place to work. It's a great place to raise a family. And then we talk about then other things like our global connectivity. So Sky Harbor Airport is rated one of the best airports in the country, and we just have grown new connections to Asia, direct flights to Taiwan just in the last couple of months. So companies also then have an ability not just to tap a local market or a domestic market, but an international market. Mm-hmm. So that gives them room to scale. And so those are just some of the things we talk about in addition to just the weather, which usually always comes up. But we like to tell them that for 8 or 9 months of the year, it's absolutely beautiful. And then we have a little bit of a hotter summer.
You don't fly them out in August or July.
No, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
I mean, let me ask you about some of those headwinds, right? Like some of the questions you might get that are on the other side of that, like especially with water at the forefront of the conversation right now as we're kind of looking at these negotiations over Colorado River water and looking at how Arizona may fare and how it may not be so good for our state heading forward. Do you get a lot of companies saying like, are you going to have water there in the future? How much will it cost?
We always have questions about resources, whether they're natural or resources like power, for example. Yeah. And I'm confident that there are folks at the city who are handling negotiations. I know our mayor came out and was very vocal with her position that we need to have a compromise and an agreement that is beneficial to Phoenix given our importance in the national economy, the fact that we're making chips here that are going out to global markets. That's very significant. But with companies, we talk about also the very forward-thinking approach that we've taken to economic development, going back all the way to the Great Recession. You know, we have built in sustainable practices when it comes to water and power. We always look to the future. And so I think that gives companies a level of confidence that we're not just thinking about tomorrow. We're thinking about the next year and the next 10 years.
Yeah. Is it often, though, when it comes to business, right, just down to the dollars and cents, right? Like, you know, what are the tools in your toolbox in terms of the regulatory landscape here, the kind of offers you can give them, tax breaks, et cetera, to try to spur these industries that matter?
Well, we use a variety of economic development tools, whether that's to help develop land. We work with developers who often pay for infrastructure to be put into areas like up around TSMC where we have a potential growth opportunities with new developments. And we have tools that help us cost share those infrastructure expenses. And there's other tools we can use that we've used with the downtown revitalization that are more on the tax side. What I think is most important is goes beyond just the incentives or the tax breaks. It's really what is the holistic package that we provide. And I've never seen in my time in economic development a deal that started with discussions about incentives.
Yeah. Let me ask you about the big picture here in terms of where you see Phoenix headed in the future as you're kind of, you know, here to help guide it in that direction, right? Like, we have, as we said, been the fastest growing metropolis in the country for a long time, and we're starting to see that shift a little bit. We're starting to see it not be so cheap to live here, not be so cheap to move here, prices going up, things like that. How do you see the future in terms of the big picture landscape of, like, the arc of this place that, you know, can't grow forever?
Well, from an industry standpoint, I really believe that we are pushing the boundaries of innovation constantly here. And so that's going to, I think, unlock more potential for future industries to come here, or subsets of industries. Mm-hmm. So I've talked about aerospace, for example, but, you know, looking at unmanned aerial vehicles as a potential option for growth. So that I am confident is going to continue, because Phoenix has been forward-looking for the last 10, 15 years, and that is now part of just our DNA.
Yeah.
And part of my job is going to be continuing to do that and pushing the boundaries and looking over the horizon to see what's coming next. Secondly, I think we still do have room to grow and grow smartly, and that's what Phoenix has also done. I think we've been very deliberate about our growth, figuring out ways to redevelop our downtown, to do infill development in certain neighborhoods. And then, yeah, we're pushing the boundaries into the desert a little bit too, but I think we're doing that in a very smart, planned way that's mindful of things like resource allocations and mindful of things like even traffic and you know, how you build new roads and pedestrian bridges and bike lanes and all those kind of things. I'm very confident that we're going to continue to do that, and I think that's what's going to keep us at the top of the list in terms of places for business.
Okay. Ryan Tuhill, Community and Economic Development Director for the City of Phoenix, joining us. Ryan, thank you for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. On the wish list of birthday presents many of us may compile, a colonoscopy would likely not be near the top. But for our next guest's 47th birthday, that is exactly what he got himself. And he decided to write about it and raise awareness of the need for this kind of cancer screening. Gustavo Arellano is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. He talked about his experience with our co-host Mark Brody, and they started with why Arellano chose to finally get a colonoscopy after having put it off for a while.
When you think about a colonoscopy, you think about older folks. And look, I'm now 47 years old. I'm no spring chicken anymore. But you're thinking of people in their late 50s, 60s. And part of it is because for decades, health officials and the health industry, for that matter, they recommended that your first colorectal cancer screening start at age 50. But in 2021, that got recommended to go down to 45. Not a colonoscopy necessarily. There's other ways to test for colorectal cancer. And obviously, the message still hasn't gotten around that much. And one of the reasons why they suggested doing that is because rates of colorectal cancer are increasing dramatically among younger people. And so for myself, I knew this. I obviously, as a reporter, I tend to focus a little bit more on what the news is just in everything. And even though I knew this, I'm like, well, you know, I'm healthy, right? My physicals are always good. My blood level's good. Cancer, colorectal cancer does not run on either side of my family. Heart conditions is what I have to focus on as a male because of my dad's side of the family. So I at age 45, my doctor said you should get one, and I delayed it.
And what finally convinced you to go and do it?
Shame, of course. My doctor, she's a great doctor, and she said, hey, so I noticed you didn't get that colorectal screening that I suggested after you turned 45, and you ignored the take-home test that I sent to you after you ignored the colonoscopy. What's going on? And I said, I'm sorry, that's my fault. Let's do this. And she's like, well, I could send you the take-home test. I'm like, you know what? No, let's just do the whole thing. I'm not afraid of it, but you kind of called me out.
And you mentioned your dad earlier, and as you write in your column, he had had a colonoscopy, but it was many years ago, right? Like, he hadn't had one since then.
Yeah, once I figured out that I'm going to do this, so I want to do a little bit more research. And as it turns out, Latinos, especially Mexican Americans, especially Mexican American men, of which I'm all three, our rates of checking colorectal cancer are abysmal. And so when I mentioned it to my dad, he said, yeah, I got it. And I actually thought he was going to tell me he had never gotten one before because he's old school Mexican. And, you know, sadly, a lot of macho men have issues with anything involving their butt. Let's just be honest about this. And so he surprised me when he said that he got one. Then I said if he had ever gotten another one. He couldn't remember when it happened. He's 74, so probably 15 years ago, maybe when he was 60.
Yeah.
Which, again, is kind of a little bit late. So I said, why did your doctor never schedule another one? He's like, you know what? I don't know. And, of course, the next question I asked, was everything okay? He's like, yeah, that's not a problem.
Well, so you mentioned that, you know, when a lot of people think about colonoscopies, they think about older people. I think the other thing a lot of people think about is the prep for it, which can be, you know, not the most pleasant experience in the world. How did you find that? And I'm curious, you know, how, what you were thinking about as you were doing it, especially having, you know, put it off for a couple of years.
All you hear about is horror stories when it comes to colonoscopies.
Yeah.
And so when the actual process, no, it's not even scary. And of course, what people always talked about being terrible was the so-called prep. So you have to cleanse your gastrointestinal system completely. Without getting too graphic about it, you basically drink a humongous jug of a liquid. And in the past, it has been compared to everything from oil, like car oil, to gasoline, to sweaty socks, to all sorts of stuff. I got to say, on my end, it wasn't that bad. They gave me some lemon flavored powder to put into it over 3 hours. The only uncomfortable thing really was you try drinking 3 liters of anything, even your favorite drink, 3 liters in 3 hours, basically an 8 ounce glass every 15 minutes. Yeah, that kind of creeps up on you. And so, and my, what I tasted, honestly, it tasted like citrus blossom water. So, you know, very much used in Middle Eastern pastry. So kind of thick. So after a while, I kind of got heavy. I would have liked it with a shot of mezcal, but I was not going to do that.
Yeah, I don't think that's part of the recommended treatment plan there.
Yeah, and then the aftermath, I mean, look, it's what we all do. It's nature dialed up to 11, sure. So a little bit more than usual, a little bit just one after another. But that part didn't scare me at all because, again, it's nature.
Yeah. How much of a cultural shift, how much of like a shift in thinking do you think it would take to bring the numbers of people who do not get screened right now to get screened?
Huge. I mean, I'll talk specifically about my two demographics, being a Mexican-American male, then just being 45 through 49. According to the American Cancer Society, only 9% of Mexican-American people between 45 and 49 have been tested for colorectal cancer. Compare that to 20% of our white peers. Both of them, by the way, are super, super low statistics that both need to be upped dramatically. And then when it comes to Mexican-American men, we are the group that in the survey that the American Cancer Society took, and this is, they published it last year, we lag behind Cuban American men, between Central American men, South, basically all Latin American men, Mexican American men are the ones who are least likely to be tested. They attribute factors to income level, because if you're more working class or poor, you're going to have harder access to medical anything. And also just, you know, the fact that people are not talking about this. They're still, I got to say, when I went to go get my prep, the pharmacists, these are the pharmacists, they either euphemistically referred to what I was going to get to as my procedure, or one like basically tripped over saying the word colonoscopy. And so there's a shame attached in America, again, to anything involving the butt, anything involving our innards. And that's the thing with me. I was never ashamed of doing the process. It was other stupidities. If, you know, as we say in Spanish, pendejadas, stupidities that got in the way, not the actual procedure itself.
Do you find that the reasons that the American Cancer Society found for why so many Mexican-American men, especially in that age demographic, don't get colonoscopies, does that ring true to you?
It does. I mean, it reminds me of what happened during the COVID-19 vaccine rollout, where there was a lot of lagging among Mexican-Americans, Latinos in general, but Mexican-Americans. I wrote about it. I wrote about it specifically with my dad, who didn't want to get the COVID vaccine because of all this misinformation. There's no misinformation when it comes to colonoscopies. I think it's just a matter of you know, we all think we're going to live forever. And again, and I can't overemphasize how people think colonoscopies are for people in their mid-50s and older, and especially in the younger generation. Even if when you're in your mid-40s, you don't think that's going to be you. But we have to get over that. We have to do it. It is such a simple procedure. And if you have healthcare, especially, it's not supposed to cost you anything. Your healthcare providers, by dictate of the government, have to provide something like a colonoscopy for you for free, like or as low cost as possible. All that this cost me, I had to pay like a dollar for my prep, that big, huge jug, which that was it. That was it.
All right. That is Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times. Gustavo, good as always to talk to you. Thank you.
Gracias.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. For decades now, the Chinese government has limited the Chinese public's access to the internet. But the results of that intervention haven't exactly gone according to plan. The government's policies don't mean it's impossible to access the internet. It just means that Chinese innovators have to get creative. Journalist and ASU New America fellow Yiling Lu has a new book about this called The Wall Dancers, Searching for Freedom and Connection on the Chinese Internet. As she told me recently, back in the late 1990s, the Chinese government recognized that the rapid spread of unfiltered internet access might pose a threat to their interests.
And so to solve this problem, they constructed an online censorship system called the Golden Shield Project, which would informally become known as the Great Firewall. And the goal was to just control the flow of information while keeping some things out. So concretely, it started out as this piece of software that filters traffic passing through the web, blocking IP addresses. But since then, it's evolved into a much more complex system of censorship. And that's everything from kind of cyberspace regulators to rank and file content moderators to the kind of self-censorship that many citizens internalize.
Well, so this gets to the phrase that is in the title of your book, and that is wall dancers. Tell us what you mean by wall dancers.
Yeah, so this term, the wall dancers, comes from a Chinese phrase, dancing in shackles. And it was first used in the early 2000s by journalists, Chinese journalists, to describe what it meant to write and report under state constraints. But since then, it's become much more widely used. And I've heard all kinds of people use this phrase, from science fiction writers to musicians to software engineers. And it resonated with me in particular because it described this experience that I found I was having living in China, which was this kind of dynamic push and pull between state and society. It was this experience of living in a place that was on one hand rich with innovation, and yet on the other rigidly constrained, that kind of swung wildly between freedom and control. And I came to realize that this dance was most dynamic on the Chinese internet.
And this is an important subtlety, right? Because I think for some people, when they think of the Chinese internet, there is this assumption that there is this wall that makes certain types of innovation, as you put it, impossible, when in fact, a tremendous amount of innovation has taken place. And that has happened, in your framing, through this dance. It's not so much that it's in spite of the Golden Shield. It's more of this interplay, right?
Absolutely. I think often people who aren't on the Chinese internet or haven't been to China kind of assume that the ecosystem that exists behind this great firewall is totally barren. Like, nothing is allowed in. You can't have Facebook. You can't have Google. Sensitive words vanish. And there's no innovation and no culture and no community. But, you know, that couldn't be further from the truth. Instead of becoming a barren landscape, the Chinese internet within the wall flowered into this entirely alternate ecosystem.
Let's talk about the individuals who you were really drawn to and who you profile and chronicle in the book. One of them is this former police officer who ends up founding a gay dating app named Maoba Li.
Yeah, I just found it fascinating that here was a man who grew up and was a teenager at a time when homosexuality was still not yet decriminalized in China. It was still considered a mental illness. And yet on one hand, he was able to keep his job as a cop for 10 years by day and by night run this underground gay website that would grow and fast forward to a couple decades later become the largest gay dating app, not just in China, in the world. So it was fascinating to me how he could get from A to B. And I think what allowed him to do so was that he straddled many worlds. He was a dancer while he belonged as part of a minority community and was trying to gain greater queer visibility for Chinese, the Chinese queer community. On the other hand, he knew what it was like to work within the police bureau, and so he could speak the language of authority, and he could know what red lines not to cross and what allegiances to build, and this allowed him to identify leverage points for change.
Yeah, and another reason it seems like this work is significant up to this moment is that, as you have pointed out, the U.S. internet and the Chinese internet are really starting to resemble each other, potentially necessitating American internet users to learn some dance steps.
Absolutely. I'd say this is something that I wasn't expecting as I started writing this book, but the parallels have become increasingly resonant, particularly in the last year. My book is very much about the kind of romance of the Chinese internet as this force of liberalization and how that's waned and faded. But I've realized that so has the fantasy of a kind of free and open World Wide Web.
Yeah.
One parallel that I like to draw is just between Weibo, which is China's largest microblogging site, and X. Back in the early 2010s, Weibo was kind of called this harbinger of free speech. And today it's completely constrained and overrun with incels and patriotic trolls. Hmm. And Twitter, now X, was once kind of praised as this throbbing networked intelligence and was going to bring about the Arab Spring in the early 2010s. My fellow journalists now call a cesspool, right, or a hell site.
Yeah.
And its content moderation policies is shaped by the whims of one of the world's most powerful men. I think both in China and the United States, we're seeing this allegiance between the tech elite and political power.
Yeah. I mean, just to share an experience of my own that I had recently that took place after the transfer of ownership of the TikTok algorithm to a U.S. company. I had been reporting on a protest against an ICE warehouse here in the Valley, and I went to post a video that I had created, and I went to tag it using the tag ICE, and it said there were no videos on the entire platform that had this tag. And I thought, that seems impossible.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the TikTok sale is, and the reaction to the TikTok sale is perhaps one of the clearest illustrations of this trend that in some ways the US and Chinese internets are starting to look alike. Because I think for the longest time, this sense of this questioning of how much is TikTok being influenced was very much rooted with ByteDance, which is the Chinese company that owned TikTok. And people were questioning, you know, well, to what extent can ByteDance influence the feeds on TikTok? And to what extent does the relationship between ByteDance and the Chinese government then shape what shows up on user feeds? And now that TikTok has been sold, it's not like those concerns have really gone away, because the U.S. companies that have acquired TikTok, some of them include Oracle, for example, and the questions are now, well, to what extent does Oracle have influence over shaping what shows up on user feeds? And, you know, to what extent is it influenced by Oracle's tight links to the current administration? So even though ownership has shifted, the systems of algorithmic control and influence are very much still in place.
Well, I have been speaking with journalist Yiling Liu, who is the author of The Wall Dancers and is also an ASU New America Fellow. Yiling Liu, thank you for this conversation.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. That's it for today's edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow with much more. Don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram if you are on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. And don't forget to sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It's called Radioheads, and you can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. And, of course, happy Lunar New Year to you all. As the show's Claire Lawton said in last week's newsletter, buckle up for the Year of the Fire Horse, Sam.
That's right. We wish you all a year of strength, grace, endurance, loyalty, freedom, and success.
Love it.
A great way to guarantee all of those things is to listen to tomorrow's edition of the show, which will be right back here at 9 a.m. For Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you then.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.